This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sebastian Sung, professor of computational neuroscience and physics at MIT and investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Sebastian has made important advances in artificial intelligence and neuroscience. His research has been published in leading scientific journals and also featured in the New York Times, Technology Review, and The Economist. Sebastian Sung is here today to tell us about his book, Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are, published in 2012. Welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
What exactly is a connectome?
A connectome is a map of the connections between neurons in your brain. If you want to imagine it, you might think of a map that you find in the back pages of in-flight magazines. Imagine that every city in that map is replaced by a neuron, and every route between two cities is replaced by a connection between two neurons.
And why are connectomes important?
They're important because they really provide the physical basis for your mind. So I love the fact that the title of your show is Mind Over Matters, and indeed, the relationship between mind and matter has been something that philosophers have wondered about for a long time, and neuroscientists are making progress. The connectome is the map of the network which supports the activity patterns, the electrical signals and chemical signals that circulate, and neuroscientists think that's the function of your mind.
In the book, you make the statement, you are your connectome. Would you say more?
Right. So imagine that map in the back of the in-flight magazine. Your map is much more complicated looking. I gave you the basic idea by invoking that metaphor, but imagine a map that has 100 billion cities, and it has 10,000 flights coming out of each city. That's what your connectome is like. And the hypothesis that neuroscientists have is that your memories are somehow stored inside that pattern of connections between neurons, that every person's connectome is unique. And so your individuality, your personal identity, beyond memories, maybe intelligence, maybe even mental disorders, are somehow encoded in that connectome.
Would you comment on the relative importance of genes in the structure of connectomes?
Well, connectomes are really important because they are influenced by both experiences and genes. So every time that you have an experience, the pattern of connections, the flight map inside your head, that gets modified. And people think that's how memories are stored. But at the same time, genes also have an influence on your connectome. And we've had debates about this genes experiences thing for a long time, right? We all know that people often resemble their parents, not only in their looks, but in the way that they behave. And we've had big arguments about whether that's due to upbringing or due to genetic inheritance. But scientists all accept the idea now that both are important. Both genes and experiences have an influence on the mind. And the challenge is to go beyond these kinds of philosophical debates and answer the question, precisely how do experiences have an effect on your brain? Precisely how do genes have an effect on your brain? That's how we need to make progress. Now, genes have an effect on your brain in many different ways, but a powerful way is by influencing how your connectome is created during brain development when you're a kid, when you're a young child, or even in the womb. There's a lot of complicated steps involved in wiring up a brain. The neurons have to be born, those 100 billion neurons, and they have to migrate to their proper positions in a complex dance. And then they send out branches. You know that neurons look like trees, so they send out these long, beautiful branches which entangle, they intertwine, and at points where they touch, they can make these synapses. They're special junctions where neurons communicate, and that constitutes a connection. So genes affect our brains powerfully because they actually guide all of these processes of brain development.
How set is the structure of our connectomes? How much do they change over time?
Oh, yeah, that's a big question that everybody wants to know the answer to. So we all know, anecdotally at least, that it sometimes seems harder to learn things as we get older. So scientists have hypothesized perhaps your connectome doesn't change as easily as you get older. But the evidence for this has been hard to really nail down precisely. There are four mechanisms of connectome change that scientists have identified. I call them the four R's: reweighting, reconnection, rewiring, and regeneration. Reweighting means a change in the strength of an existing connection. So reweighting would change how effectively a connection transmits a signal from one neuron to another. That's the most minor kind of change in a connectome. Reconnection means the creation of new synapses or the elimination of old ones. Then rewiring is the growth of new branches of neurons or the retraction of those branches. And regeneration would be the creation of entirely new neurons or the elimination of old neurons. It's believed that reweighting happens throughout your life. Lifelong learning is enabled by the fact that reweighting is possible even when you're old. You can always learn new things. Reconnection was thought to stop in adulthood in the 1960s, but it's now known that reconnection also continues in adulthood. So the battleground has been about rewiring and regeneration. And in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of impressive evidence that rewiring stopped in adulthood, which could explain why we can't learn things as well. But these days, there's some revisionists, some rebels who are finding new evidence that even rewiring can occur in the adult brain. So it's a controversial subject.
What is known about what causes connectomes to change?
So that's been investigated the most for the case of reweighting. There's a famous idea that when two neurons are active simultaneously, that the connection between them gets strengthened. So you might imagine, let's say that I have an experience, and that experience is activating some ensemble of neurons inside the brain. Then afterwards, that ensemble is more strongly connected due to that experience. And the hypothesis goes that those stronger connections constitute the physical trace of the memory that's been stored. Now, what's driving the other processes? Who knows? In reweighting, there's also weakening of synapses. It may be that when a synapse gets weakened progressively, eventually it just gets eliminated. That's a reasonable hypothesis, but hasn't really been proven.
What is known as a solid fact about learning?
Well, we know that the reweighting of connections occurs in association with learning. We know that it can be triggered by activity, but it's been hard to see the entire pattern of connections that gets created when we store a memory. That's something that my lab and other labs are going after. We're trying to develop new technologies for seeing connectomes so that we can actually see memories, literally see the material basis for a stored memory inside the brain.
And how do you propose that would look?
Well, I should explain the kind of steps required to find connectomes. So I've talked about the connectome as this map that resembles an airline route map. How do you actually get that from a real brain? And this involves some interesting technologies. The first step is to take a brain. You have to image the brain at extremely high resolution because the branches of neurons are so tiny, they're so thin, that if you don't look with a sufficient resolution, then it just looks like a total entangled mess. So we use a technology called electron microscopy, which is, I guess, the keenest kind of microscopy known. It's much more high resolution than even light microscopy, which you've probably used in your high school biology class. Now, it's not enough to get to use an electron microscope because brain tissue is three-dimensional. So the first thing that we do with the brain, and this is with a dead brain, we take it and we cut it into extremely thin slices with a high-tech version of your deli slicer. It's fitted with the world's sharpest knife, the diamond knife. And we cut the brain into slices that are 1,000 times thinner than a hair. And then we image it. And once we image all those slices, we have a kind of a virtual brain, a three-dimensional image of all the neurons and all the synapses inside that brain. And now, if we want to find the connectome, we have to go inside that image and trace out the pathways that all those branches take and find all the synapses. And then we can map out those routes, effectively, that are kind of like the routes that the neural signals are taking. And that's how we can find the connectome. Now, that's a time-consuming process, and we're developing advanced computer algorithms for doing that automatically. And we're also asking people to come help us because computers aren't smart enough to do this accurately, really accurately. We need people to oversee the activities of the artificial intelligence. And there's a website called iwire.org, E-Y-E-Wire.org, where any people who are interested in learning about neuroscience get the opportunity to do neuroscience, to discover new things about the retina, which is the sheet of neural tissue at the back of the eye.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sebastian Sung, author of the book Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are, And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What can connectomes tell us about disorders of the brain?
Oh, yes. So clearly, one of the reasons to be interested in the brain is just curiosity. But another practical reason is that there's plenty of ways in which brains can not function the way that we want them to. So mental disorders are a big problem for our society. Now, there's some kinds of brain disorders in which we can clearly see that the brain is falling apart. In Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, if you look at the brains of people after death during an autopsy, and you look through a microscope, you can see junk accumulating inside neurons, and you can see neurons dying. There's obviously something wrong. And that helps guide research towards finding good treatments. But in other brain disorders, such as autism or schizophrenia, the neurons look healthy. If you look at the brains, it's hard to find a clear and consistent abnormality. You might find abnormalities in some people, but they're not consistent across different patients, which suggests that those abnormalities are just the same kind that you and I might have, and they're not necessarily related with the disorder itself. So this has been a huge puzzle. How come people with autism and schizophrenia behave so differently, and yet we can't find something obviously abnormal about the brains? And in fact, it retarded acceptance of schizophrenia as a brain disorder, right? So for 100 years, people did not want to accept the idea that it was a brain disorder. And I think only in the last sort of 20, 30 years has the public come to accept this idea. So what could be wrong with the brain? Well, think about the back of your stereo system, all those cables going back and forth between the components. If I were to mischievously go behind your stereo and switch around some of those wires, your stereo wouldn't work anymore. But if you just casually glance at the back of your stereo, you wouldn't notice anything wrong. You'd actually have to trace the pathway of one cable from one component to another component. So the same thing might be true about the brain. Maybe the neurons are perfectly healthy in these disorders, but they're wired up differently. Maybe there's miswirings of the brain, or we call them now connectopathies. So a big goal of my research is to search for connectopathies. I think that would be really important discovery if we could find them and help guide research towards treatments.
What is some of the evidence that suggests these connectopathies actually exist?
Well, of course, we haven't found them yet, so it's really in some ways just a hunch. But some abnormalities, statistical abnormalities, have been found. So, for example, we know that autistic children, on average, tend to have larger brains than regular children. At a very young age, maybe on average, a 10% larger brain. Now, that's a statistical abnormality. It only is apparent when you examine averages. If you took every kid with a big head and said that kid is autistic, that would be woefully inaccurate. So the average differences in size, though, suggest that there must be some difference in structure, right? And maybe if we have a more refined measure of structure than size. Size is such a crude measure of structure. If we have a refined measure of organization, we might be able to find the abnormalities that we're looking for.
What are your thoughts on how aberrant connectomes, how mistakes in connections within the brain can be fixed?
Oh, yes. So the obvious question would be, suppose that you found indeed that one of these mental disorders is caused by miswiring of the brain, then wouldn't a cure require fixing the miswiring? That's true. And so in the end, if we want a cure, I think it would be necessary to harness the brain's natural capacity for plasticity, right? The brain naturally has the ability to change, has mechanisms for connectome change. So there must be some way of using them. And maybe we can develop drugs, special technologies for turning up the brain's plasticity. You could imagine that maybe we become less plastic as we get older, but there may be drugs that could enhance that plasticity. And those drugs could be important. I'm just speculating, but they could be important for treating mental disorders.
In your book, you mentioned the thought that some antidepressants could act through connectomes. Would you expand on that idea?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So the story of antidepressants is really a very interesting one. Amazingly, they were discovered by accident. It turned out that these drugs did have the effect of making people happier. And then only later on was it discovered that these drugs alter the level of certain neurotransmitters. So let's say serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical that's secreted by neurons to signal to each other inside the brain. So the natural theory then grew up to explain why antidepressants work. The theory said that, well, maybe people who are depressed don't have enough serotonin, and the antidepressants are fixing that by increasing the levels of serotonin. That's a very popular theory of neurotransmitter imbalance. But that theory, remember, was made up after the fact, and it's not really even clear that it's correct. It's just a hunch. And one difficult fact to explain is that antidepressants typically take several weeks before they have any effect on mood, and yet they change neurotransmitter levels effectively immediately. So an obvious kind of hypothesis would be that actually these antidepressants, by changing serotonin levels, they are now changing the ability of the connectome to change. And so some kind of change occurs in the brain over the next few weeks, and it's that change in the brain which then causes the change in mood.
Would you go into some more detail about how experiences actually change the brain and what things are most important for changing it?
Well, I want to emphasize here that I'm approaching this with a sense of humility that comes from knowing how limited neuroscience knowledge is about change. In fact, one of the reasons to study connectomes is precisely because we've been frustrated in our ability to know exactly what happens in the brain when we learn something new, when we recover from a brain injury. Is there a particular kind of change that you'd like me to address? Because the answers might be different for different kinds of changes.
Well, let's say a change in behavior. You're trying to improve yourself in some way.
Right. Well, I guess the biggest change that we want to make is changing habitual patterns of behavior, right? That we may be smoking, we may get angry too easily. There may be certain habits that are somehow ingrained in us that are very hard to change. So habitual patterns of behavior are presumably due to pathways in the brain that have been created that go from one neuron to another. So stimulus response pathways, right? So you see a cigarette and then what you want to do is smoke. The simple answer of how that happens that's given by neuroscientists is that there's some visual neurons which are activated when you see the cigarette, and those are connected through some pathways to other neurons which then make you want to smoke. So it's a difficult question to know what exactly is happening when we try to break those habits. Are we somehow trying to weaken the synapses that are involved in driving that pathway of behavior? Or is there some other part of the brain which overrules that behavior? So I don't know that we really have any kind of fundamental answers about how that happens. I would guess that both are actually happening. But the overrule idea may be more correct, because we all know that it's easy to relapse, right? The fact that when you give up smoking, and let's say you give up smoking for 5 years, and then all of a sudden, if you start taking a cigarette again, you feel that incredible urge, and then you start to smoke, and the old behavior comes back. So that suggests that the old pathways have never truly gone away.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sebastian Sung, author of the book Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are. Would you comment on the need for new technologies to study the connectome hypothesis? You alluded to that a bit earlier.
Yeah, so the new technologies are needed because the brain just has a fantastically intricate structure. Most people are familiar with MRI machines, the machines that enable you to look through the skull of a person and see a living brain. And those are a fantastic new technology that's emerged over the last few decades. But most people aren't aware that the resolution, spatial resolution of those imaging methods is really crude. So let's say that one pixel in an MRI picture, it might be 1 millimeter on a side. But 1 millimeter of brain might contain 100,000 neurons and a billion connections between neurons. So you've got a whole universe inside that 1 cubic millimeter, and you would never see it if you're looking through MRI.
What do you think is the best approach to better understand connectomes?
Well, the approach that we're taking really is to try to improve our technologies over time and actually be able to map the connections completely. So in the past, people have attempted methods that might map only a few connections out of a whole complicated network. But we're hoping that our technologies will steadily improve over time and enable us eventually to map all connections inside that cubic millimeter, or maybe even all connections inside an entire brain.
And what kind of time frame do you predict for this project?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a great question. So how long will it take for technology to progress to the point where we could do an entire human brain, for example? Well, we would have to be optimistic. I would be optimistic here. A lot of it depends, interestingly, on the progress in computers. So two kinds of technologies are required: imaging, taking the images of the brain, and the second one is analyzing the images and finding the connectome from them. The second step requires computers. And you know that computers have improved at an incredible rate over the last 50 years. So if we optimistically assume that computers will improve at the same rate, the same impressive rate that they've been improving in the past, then maybe in another 40, 50 years, we would be in a position to find entire human connectomes without too much difficulty.
In your book, you propose that death is the destruction of connectomes. Would you say more?
Well, that's just a natural outcome of the earlier statement that you are your connectome. If indeed your memories are encoded in your connectome, then ultimately death is really about the destruction of those patterns of connection, destruction of that information. It's not really about your heart stopping or your breathing stopping. It's really about the destruction of the information that makes you you. So that's the motivation for the concept of connectome death.
And in your book, you mentioned a few examples of people being cooled down and the effect on their memory, that sort of thing. Would you like to say more?
Oh, yeah. Those are fantastic stories. Occasionally, there are terrible accidents when people fall into icy waters and lie submerged at the bottom of a lake, frozen lake, for maybe 45 minutes. And during that time, the temperature of their body drops so low that most chemical processes are really slowed down so much, they basically stop. And so there's no signal circulating in your brain. There's no heart pumping, no circulation of the blood. And sometimes these people are pulled out of the water and somehow they survive. And not only do they survive, the amazing thing is that their memories are largely intact. They might not remember what happened that caused them to fall into the icy water, but the memories of their whole life are essentially still preserved. So this is an important observation because it says that the activity of neurons, the signaling of neurons that's very dynamic, that's not necessary for long-term memories. That long-term memories seem to be stored in something more stable, and that's this material structure in the brain, and the connectome is really the summary of that material structure.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Yes, that's a great question, right? Because, so you're asking me sort of, why did I write this book? And it's an important question because writing a book is hard work and is sometimes painful. It's like being in solitary confinement almost. The paradox, of course, is that you're trying to bring a message to the world and yet you have to spend so much time alone. Well, indeed, I thought about this as I wrote the book. There's many different reasons. One, of course, is to just communicate the excitement of neuroscience to the public. And the second is to influence my colleagues to argue for a particular way of doing neuroscience. Science in textbooks seems like a dry thing, but in fact, if you're talking about the frontiers of knowledge and how should we go forward, scientists often have a lot of disagreements, different opinions about what's the right way to discover new things. And so this book is part of an ongoing discussion on what the future of neuroscience should be. But I would say the last thing is that I felt that the quest to find a connectome is an incredible story with a certain mythic power. And that story just wanted to get out of me. Well, let's consider a different quest, maybe an inverted quest, which is that of constructing artificial intelligence. So any kid these days can go to the movies and see these robots that talk and walk like humans and come away with this dream, I'm going to create an intelligent computer. And kids like that come to me at MIT, right? Students in my classes say, I've had this dream since I was a kid. I wanted to make a computer that's intelligent, one that's even more intelligent than I am. So this is a kind of mythic quest for humanity that's been around for a long time, and it continues to capture the imaginations of people. But neuroscience is a similar quest, which is the quest to deconstruct our own brains, to take them apart, to figure out what makes them tick, and fundamentally to know ourselves. And so the book tries to make explicit this notion of a quest that we're all on and have people appreciate that poetic mystery beyond simply textbook accounts of this fact or that fact about the brain.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message is that we know so little about the brain right now, but because of the development of many fantastic new technologies, including those for finding connectomes, neuroscience is entering an incredible era of discovery in which we're going to learn a lot, and we're going to address many of the really important questions that people wonder about, not just minutiae, not details, but the big questions about how we learn and change, how mental disorders are based on the structure of the brain, and so on.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sebastian. You have just been listening to Sebastian Sung, professor of computational neuroscience and physics at MIT, and author of the book, Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are, published in 2012 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. For more information, check on the web at www.connectomethebook.com. Again, that's connectomethebook.com. And another website is iwire.org. That's eyewire.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.